Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, telemedicine has become a vital part of healthcare, but will this change as the pandemic eases? Also, we'll interview award-winning chef Peter Serpico about his new book on Korean cuisine. But to begin, we bring you the latest on environmental hazards at the former Philadelphia Energy Solutions refinery. We're closing in on the 3-year anniversary of a catastrophic explosion and fire at the South Philly plant, which led to a shuttering and sale of the site and the layoff of over 1,000 workers. The new owner, Hilco Redevelopment Partners, is tearing down the old refinery operation. The goal, to eventually open a giant e-commerce distribution and commercial hub called the Bellwether District. But as the renovation unfolds, environmental advocates say residents of nearby neighborhoods are potentially being exposed to high levels of a cancer-causing chemical called benzene. WHYY's Sophia Schmidt covers the environment for WHYY's Plan Philly, and she joins us now with more on this story. Hi, Sophia.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So let's start talking about benzene. What is it, and how does it harm human health?
Yeah, so benzene is a natural part of crude oil and gasoline. It's a clear or light yellow liquid at room temperature, but it evaporates really quickly, and it's not good to breathe in. If you have a really acute high-level exposure of it, there can be symptoms like dizziness or unconsciousness. It can also impact the immune system or blood, and it's a known human carcinogen. So long-term exposure to high levels of benzene in the air can cause leukemia.
The Environmental Integrity Project recently released an analysis of benzene emissions at the site. Briefly, what is the EIP and what did their report have to say?
Yeah, so this is an environmental nonprofit. They think of themselves as a watchdog group. They were founded by former EPA staff. And the last few years, they've released this annual report looking at benzene levels at the fence lines of petroleum refineries across the country. So they're using data that these refining companies collect themselves and then submit to the EPA in compliance with an EPA rule that's been in effect since 2018. So in the case of the former Philadelphia refinery, there are about 30 monitors around the fence line of the larger portion of the site that's in South Philly, so on the east bank of the Schuylkill. And so this nonprofit was comparing this data of over 100 refineries in the U.S. Most are still operating. And the big headline here was that the former PES refinery in Philly, despite the fact that it's no longer operating, there were actually levels of benzene found at the fence line that were higher than dozens of operational refineries. So to break this down a little bit, there were two measures that the nonprofit looked at. One is an EPA compliance-based metric that tries to isolate the contribution of just the refinery by taking out any background levels of benzene that might be in the community. And EPA compares it to an action level. If the refinery is above this, they might be required to try to investigate the source of these emissions and make a plan to abate them. And the former PES site was found to be at a level that's double this action level in 2021. The other way that the nonprofit broke down the data was more of a health-based metric. Mm-hmm. So they looked at every 2 weeks, what is the highest, the monitor around the fence line, which one is picking up the highest level, and then average that over the year. Compare it to a measure that indicates potential long-term health threat. This is a pretty low level that California uses for an occupational exposure. So assuming you're exposed over 8 hours a day. And for this level, the former PES refinery was 6 times the level in 2021. Wow. So kind of crazy. This thing is shut down, but it's it has levels of benzene that are higher than dozens of operating refineries.
Yeah, and tens of thousands of people, Sophia, live near this site. Tell us about these neighborhoods.
Yeah, so closest ones to the east of the refinery in South Philly, you've got Grays Ferry, you've got Girard Estates, West Pashunk area, Point Breeze. To the west, so in southwest Philly, across the river, there's Eastwick. Most of these neighborhoods, Point Breeze, Grays Ferry, Eastwick, are predominantly people of color, black Philadelphians. Girard Estates is mostly white. They're all kind of working class, middle class neighborhoods. The reason that I bring up the demographics is because nationally, refinery emissions are an environmental justice issue. EPA has said that communities located near the fence line of refineries have low income and minority populations nearly twice the rate of the general population nationwide. And they've even looked at people who are facing an additional cancer risk from refinery emissions. And they found that African Americans are overrepresented by a factor of more than 2 to 1. And people living below the poverty line are also overrepresented.
You spoke with Shamar Pitts, an organizer with a group called Philly Thrive and a lifelong resident of Grays Ferry. He seemed to express some anger toward Hilco. Let's take a listen.
Do you think if residents were able to have a say-so in the process of redevelopment, that they would have said, it's okay, tear down and let the benzene just run rampant freely without being checked? You think the residents would have been okay with that? We know for a fact the residents wouldn't have been okay with that.
Sophia, there is talk of a community benefits agreement. How might this help these neighborhoods?
Yeah, so a community benefits agreement, the way that activists living near the refinery envision it, would be a legal agreement between the surrounding communities. So specifically, there's this coalition, a really broad, powerful coalition of about 20 different community groups, from churches to, you know, 40th Ward Republicans, civic associations. They want to negotiate this agreement with the new owner, Hilco, and they want it to have guarantees around jobs, around anti-displacement, so in case gentrification results out of this redevelopment. And then crucially, they want guarantees around environment and environmental health. And so this is, you know, an effort that's been going on for more than a year now to try to get this agreement negotiated. As you can hear Shamar talking, like, there's kind of this building frustration among the activists that are trying to negotiate it. You know, Hilco has said they're open, but the activists feel that there hasn't been any substantive negotiations yet.
Are there theories as to where this benzene is coming from? Again, the site has been shut down.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I asked a couple air quality experts. I asked the nonprofit that we were talking about that produced the report. Their theories included, you know, maybe it's the demolition process. Maybe it's the storage tanks on site that still contain, you know, a very small fraction of the historic inventory of petroleum products, but still some petroleum products. Could it be the contaminated soil and groundwater? You know, the site has been industrial for a really, really long time. But, you know, talking to Hilco, they say that the benzene data that they collect doesn't indicate sustained elevated concentrations during demolition. They say it's not a consistently high level in any one location. They kind of threw out the theory of maybe there's a truck idling near one of these monitoring points that's elevating the levels. I also asked the EPA, and they said that because of an ongoing investigation, that all they could say at this time is the EPA continues to monitor emissions in the area. So we don't really know where these are coming from.
And where does the city stand in all this as residents, you know, seek environmental justice?
So right now the city has one important role as it pertains to the site. Well, obviously more than one, but one important role is the fact that that Hilco is currently applying for a permit modification that would reclassify the site, the industry, from refining, because it's, you know, no longer operating, to demolition. And so that's still pending. So the city will have to weigh in on that, consider all these comments that have been received, and make a decision around that. Other than that, I haven't heard much of kind of a stance one way or the other from the mayor's office, but I did speak to the office of Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, who represents the area, including the refinery. And his spokesperson said that if Hilco were to seek any kind of zoning legislation that the councilman would have to introduce, that the councilman would require a community benefits agreement before he would introduce that.
If the site is reclassified, Sophia, does this change monitoring for environmental toxins?
It actually might. So right now, I mentioned that there's this EPA rule that requires refineries to monitor and submit this data. If the site would be reclassified under this permit, it would no longer be subject to that rule. Actually, Hilco currently considers itself not to be subject to the rule because it's not operating as a refinery. So they say that they're currently monitoring voluntarily. And I pose the question to them, you know, would you continue, even if you get this permit modification and you're not technically required, would you consider voluntarily continuing this fence line monitoring? And they didn't want to commit at this point. They said, you know, we have to wait and see what the city does and what the city requires with this permit.
Yeah, frustrating for the neighborhoods. And let's get to the Eastwick neighborhood for just a moment. Again, largely African-American, borders something called the Schuylkill River Tank Farm, which is still standing. Describe the tank farm and what it is used for and what its role is moving forward.
Yeah, so I actually got to visit and tour the Schuylkill River Tank Farm this past January, which was super interesting. As the name implies, it's full of dozens of huge round metal tanks that can store petroleum. And so basically this is a storage and, you know, export terminal where this petroleum product can be loaded onto trucks and barges. That's what it historically was used for. And when Hilco bought the entire refinery complex, they promised to end refining activities, but they said they would keep and maximize the use of this tank farm near Eastwick. But the tank farm has been non-operational since last year. Because of market conditions, the company told me it wasn't profitable to be operating. They drained most of the petroleum product. There's still like minimal residual material, they call it, in five tanks. But they're not ruling out restarting it as a tank farm. In fact, they applied for a permit that would allow for them to run it as a tank farm. And the latest that I've heard from them is they're still kind of weighing their options as to how to use that site. I'll note that residents nearby don't want it to continue to be used as a tank farm with petroleum product. They want kind of a clean sweep here.
Well, yeah, and Hilco is billing the Bellwether project as cleaner, greener, and more sustainable. We've got about a minute left, Sophia. This site was in use, the entire site was in use as a refinery for over 150 years, was hugely contaminated by the process. How long will demolition and overall cleanup take? Do we know?
So demolition, Hilco said about, so last year they said it would take 4 years, but then they're ahead of schedule. So when I talked to them in January, they said they were ahead of schedule. They recently confirmed they're 65% done with demolition. So we actually might get this whole site demolished ahead of schedule. Remediation will probably take longer. So remediation is already ongoing, stuff like removing soil, pumping out contaminated groundwater and treating it, sucking out vapors from underground. That stuff is already happening. But Hilco has said that, you know, building could even start while remediation is ongoing. The other company that's doing remediation, called Evergreen, they're still kind of evaluating what needs to be done. And some of the remediation will depend on how Hilco redevelops the site.
So we're talking years. All right, Sophia Schmid,
we've got
to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure. Sophia is environmental justice reporter for WHYY News and Plan Philly. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about the future of telemedicine. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The pandemic has served as a defining moment for telemedicine. Early versions of telehealth had been around for many years, but in March of 2020, as the deadly threat posed by COVID-19 became apparent, the federal government took steps to make sure telemedicine was widely available to Medicare recipients and guaranteed doctors and other providers were equally compensated for virtual and in-office visits. Private insurers soon followed suit. The use of telehealth appointments exploded, and even as the numbers have fallen back somewhat as patients return to doctors' offices, telemedicine remains a vital source of health care for many. However, its future is uncertain. At some point, as the pandemic eases, the federal public health emergency will be lifted, and waivers, which included parity and compensation, could be lifted as well. We're going to take a look at the growing place of telemedicine in healthcare, the pros and the cons. If you have any questions or comments, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Our guest is Jed Hollander, a doctor of emergency and internal medicine. Hollander is senior vice president of healthcare delivery Innovation and Associate Dean for Strategic Health Initiatives at Thomas Jefferson University. And he joins us in studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Mary. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you here. So telemedicine has really come into its own in the past couple of years. Judd, how would you characterize this development in healthcare? A revolution?
I don't know if it's a revolution. I mean, in healthcare, it might be a revolution, but in the rest of the world, it's just what we do every day, right? I don't think anybody needed to be a super genius or super visionary to say that maybe we should apply the way we go to the bank or the way we order food or the way we order gifts for our children to healthcare. Why should healthcare be something that is so laborious? So I don't know. I have trouble thinking of it as a revolution, yeah. But it is really a step that we're just ready to finally take.
Yeah, a step that was taken primarily because of the pandemic, because I didn't know too many people who were using telemedicine.
No, we started at Jefferson. We started our program in 2014, 2015, and I had conversations with colleagues around the city. Honestly, they thought we were nuts. They couldn't see a purpose for doing it. And I would never pretend that any one of us was smart enough to know COVID was coming. But we really just saw that this is the way of the world and this is the way we're going in the future. And so we were caught, and I know we'll discuss this, but we were caught in growing out something we thought was hugely important and beneficial to patients at a time when it wasn't being paid for at all. Yeah. And so our main goal was, let's put it out there, let's let people experience it, and we use the term right-size it, so that we could make sure people knew how to do it, so that when the payer landscape changed, we could be first to market to do that. It turns out the incentive at the end wasn't the payer market changing. It was really COVID, and it was the patients needing a new way to get health care. And that was, you know, COVID's not a blessing for anybody. It's a horrible, catastrophic thing. But at least we were able to still provide care during this horrible, catastrophic pandemic.
Some of the early concern about speaking with a physician virtually was that you don't get that laying on of hands. What is the value of being in the same physical space as your patient?
So I think that's a really super tough question. And I think for some patients and some physicians or nurse practitioners, sometime that's super important. And other times, it's not really important. And I think the thing I've learned most during this is that it's not up to me as a physician to make that decision. It's up to the patient to make that decision. And so there are many patients that if you're contemplating getting a biopsy result back, and you might actually, for instance, have breast cancer, you may want to be in the room with that physician.
Sure.
But if you live 75 miles from that physician, you might rather be home with your family members around you to get those results. And I don't think the physician could predict that. So I think it's just having a good conversation and discussing what is the best next step for your care, depending on where you're at in your care cycle, is the way to go.
Judd Hollander, has telemedicine made it easier then for many people to access healthcare who wouldn't have been able to otherwise, for instance, the elderly or people in lower income neighborhoods, for
instance?
Yeah,
it's actually made it much easier. And this is contrary to popular opinion. So, Mary, I'm really glad you asked this question, because everybody likes to talk about the digital divide. And there's clearly a digital divide. And it would be great for patients if we close the digital divide. On the other hand, the thing that's a bigger divide than the digital divide is the healthcare or insurance divide. And so telemedicine allows people that may not be able to afford in-person care, may not be able to drive there, may not be able to pay for parking, may not be able to take a day off work if they're an hourly wage employee, to be able to get care, just taking 15 minutes out of their day and going nowhere. So there's a recent study that Penn published that showed it actually closed gaps based on racial demographics. And that's been our experience as well.
I was going to say a lot is going to change, though, when the public health emergency is declared to be over. Does this affect the way insurance works with telehealth and how, for instance, doctors and other providers are compensated? Because initially, Judd, you know, it wasn't equal. An office visit, you know, provided more compensation than a telemedicine visit, right?
Yeah. So this is first, I'm going to give a shout out to the federal government and a little bit to local commercial payers who, once nobody was coming to the office, they did the right thing and they paid for people to get telemedicine care. And now I'll be a bit more cynical because I'm from New York. when payers tend to have a choice between paying or not paying, particularly if they're a for-profit payer, not paying is better for their shareholders. So I believe in my conversations with every insurer, everybody knows down the road they're going to pay for telemedicine. But right now they kind of have an excuse to not do it and put the money in the bank a little bit longer. And I think we have learned telemedicine works. We saw during the pandemic people got really good health care when they had no option to get in-person care. Now, I don't think that should be the way of the future, but we do know now that clearly hybrid care, or some portion in-person and some portion via telemedicine, is a smarter, better way to go. But telemedicine isn't cheaper than in-person care. It might be for the patient, but I still have an office. If I'm seeing the patient, unless I'm doing all telemedicine, I still pay rent on the office. I might still need lab tests. I might still need x-rays. Just sometimes I don't. Now I have to add on a telemedicine platform. And so the payers tend... Yeah, and that's expensive. I mean, that could be a seven-figure cost per year for a health system. So we live in no man's land right now where I don't know what the future is going to bring. So I have to build for both bricks and mortar care, and a term I love, clicks and mortar care. And so I'm spending the most money possible while people are trying to chop away at paying for telemedicine.
Just one more question about folks who might not have been able to access healthcare before the pandemic and before telemedicine became more widely available. Again, when that federal health emergency is lifted down the road, will changes in the way insurance is applied negatively affect those who now have been brought into the fold and are getting more health care via, you know, virtual health?
I could answer that with one word, really, 100% or yes. It's going to have a dramatic negative impact. I mean, think about a wage worker that's getting less than $15 an hour that now needs to take a day off from their job or most of their job to come downtown or to go to their local doctor. Not only is there the cost of care, whether it's paid for by their payer or not, there's the loss of income and the loss of revenue on that day. So I think you'll see it impact patients more because at the end of the day, healthcare providers, they're going to follow the incentives that are put out there by the federal government and commercial payers. So they can't provide care for free. They have families, they have people, they have buildings, they have loans. There's a lot of things that require some money to come in order to be able to take care of the patients. So just chopping the amount you pay if it's telemedicine isn't really a feasible long-term solution for society, and it will have a horrible impact on access for many people.
We've been talking, Judd, about a number of times on the show about the mental health effects, following the pandemic, and we've learned that telemedicine can work really well for mental health care. Why is that?
Well, most of it's conversation or seeing the patient. I'll tell you, this is actually a fascinating area because there is actually really good data in teenagers that teenagers are more likely to disclose issues to mental health professionals on video than in person. There's actually even some data that teenagers are more likely to disclose that information to avatars, not even people, cartoons on video. That's the way they grew up and they do that. But that would be inconceivable to me if you asked me that years ago. When I look at some of our own physicians pre-pandemic, some of our mental health professionals thought it was imperative to have people in the office. They wanted to see their body language, see how it was going. Now we do 90% of our mental health care by video. It's great for patients. The providers could get just as much information, and the patients don't feel stigmatized by walking into an office to be seen. So it turns out it's a great way to provide care.
And you found that regardless of the type of health care, there are fewer no-shows since telemedicine has really taken hold.
Yeah, that's a dramatic difference.
So why do people not show up? They just can't make it that day?
They can't make it. Something comes up. And again, coming to the doctor, it's never 1 hour. It's never the 15-minute appointment. It's a half day at best. And so something comes up. If you have young kids, something comes up in school. One of them gets sick. It could be a million things. You know, the cable providers come to your house, tell you to stay home in the afternoon. They show up an hour early. You're not going to reschedule for 3 weeks from now. So you stay home. So we know across the country, 25 to 30% of scheduled appointments for tomorrow in person won't happen. Telemedicine cuts that in half.
Well, let's talk about other virtual health applications like wearables, you know, the watch that tracks a person's pulse, that sort of thing. I mean, what role might they play? What do you think?
It's going to take a while to sort that out. I mean, you could see that I have my Apple Watch on and I work out and I look at it. I like to see what my pulse rate is doing. My wife makes fun of me for that. but that's good for me. I don't know right now how that contributes to my health care. It might not. I think what we're going to do is we're going to be able to get a lot more information on people. We have to do two things. We have to figure out what information is important to get, because just information alone is not necessarily good. And then how are we going to curate it or use it to make it better for the patient? I'll tell you for sure, if the patients I'm seeing in an office for a day are sending me their heart rate every 20 seconds in the last 3 months, I don't know a physician in the world who wants that information. So we have to figure out what's important. And the other thing, which is the converse of your question, is as we go to telemedicine, when I see somebody at home, most of the time I won't have their blood pressure, and most of the time I won't have their heart rate, and most of the time I won't care. It's not important to me. So there are things we can learn from telemedicine that we could stop wasting time doing in an office visit. I don't want anybody to misinterpret. Doesn't mean blood pressure, heart rate, and vital signs aren't important. They're just not important if I'm taking your stitches out and you're 14 years old.
At what point is it vital that a person gets themselves into a doctor's office or an emergency room?
So, you know, if you're having chest pain or stroke symptoms or you can't breathe, there's a whole bunch of specific conditions that are important. And also sometimes for some people and certainly for some doctors, you do need to have an interpersonal relationship. I do most of my care by telemedicine, but I see my doctor every once in a while. I could have done that visit by telemedicine, but I like to see people, and they like to see me sometimes. You know, and so I think it's really we have to figure out how are we going to do hybrid care and how are we going to use, you know, the patient, the provider, and the machine, or as I say, the toys, the wearables, the digital devices, to integrate to give us really good care without just doing everything we can all of the time.
You related a story to Philadelphia Magazine about a conversation you had with your daughter-in-law, one which had some major health implications for her.
Yeah. She actually called me at something super early in the morning. I was asleep, or maybe she called my wife who was awake, and she was having some belly pain. And she calls for health issues with the kids, but not for herself much. And this was just audio, just a telephone call. And I said, can you just stand up and jump, which is one of the things we do in telemedicine. And if you could jump and you think it's silly that the doctor asked you to jump and you're laughing, you don't have something bad in your belly with a reasonable high degree of certainty. And I said, can you stand up and jump? She's like, I can't even move. Mm. And I asked my son, can you put your hands on both sides of a pelvis and just rock her a little? And I heard her scream. And so that's a sign of peritonitis. And so she lives in California and sent her to the ER. I'm an ER doc. ER docs all know each other. I called my buddy who runs the ER out there. And they got her in and she went to the OR for appendicitis a couple hours later.
But if she'd waited to go see a physician later in the day, it might have been a lot worse.
Probably would have ruptured and been a much longer hospital course.
Mm. You told Paige Marie Bessler, our producer, that telemedicine has given us the option to think, what info do we need and when? And that medicine was determined by gray-haired old men 150 years ago, and some of it might not hold value any longer. Do I have that right?
Yeah, she captured my cynicism. Thank you, Paige. but that was what I was talking about in terms of vital signs. We don't need everything on everybody all of the time. And if you open an electronic medical record right now, what you find is pages and pages and pages of information. And not only is more not better, more clutters up the record, so I can't find the relevant information I want. And so I think, really, as we think about medicine, there were no diagnostic tests, right? It was just what somebody thought it was, and they may not have all had gray hair, but they were mostly old men 100 years ago. And the person who was senior won. They would say, this is the murmur, this is what it is, and no one could validate it. And as much as 30 years ago, when I was in training, we had some of these senior experts who are, you know, phenomenal at detecting murmurs, were the world's leader in valvular heart disease, had written the books, and they would bring them into, you know, an auditorium, and they'd bring in a patient, and they'd put them through the maneuvers, and they would say with confidence that they have this type of murmur, and then they would do the echo, and you know what? Mm-mm. They were wrong a lot. But they were never wrong before we had an echocardiogram. And so you learn that the physical exam, honestly, is something that can help lead you to testing. It should never be all that you could do.
What are you seeing among your colleagues in healthcare? Are physicians and nurses embracing virtual medicine, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
It's a mixed bag. And it's interesting because pre-COVID, and I'm not sure how to define it, but we saw a bimodal distribution. It was docs in the 40 to 45-year-old age range and docs over 60 that embraced it. Might not have been
really
what I predicted.
Yeah.
But the way I rationalize it, as you're getting older and pre-retirement, not having the drive to work, doing it from home has advantages. When you're less than 40, you might be more comfortable with the toys and devices, but you don't have the experience and you haven't learned how to do telemedicine, and you needed at least one. When COVID hit, everybody had to learn. And so now it's probably a different demographic that's using it. And I don't have data on it, but I would suspect it's adopted by much younger. But I'll add to that, the problem with learning telemedicine is that no one knew it. It's just medicine. It's the same care delivery model. But when you learn an electronic medical record, you actually sit down next to someone who knows how to do it. And when you say, how do I put in this order, they show you. When you're learning telemedicine, you're not next to anybody who knows how to do it. Oh. Everybody learned the same day. So you couldn't look to senior people or junior people.
Yeah. Very quickly, 10 seconds, up to Congress now to rework telemedicine regulations?
Yeah, and there's support in both House and Senate and both parties, so hopefully we'll get there.
All right, Jed Hollander, Senior Vice President of Healthcare Delivery Innovation at Thomas Jefferson University. Great to have you with us. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Up next on the Regional Roundup, it is Peter Serpico, Executive Chef at K-Pod and author of a new cookbook. Stay tuned. This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Famed Philadelphia chef Peter Serpico has won some major accolades for his work, including the James Beard Award and two Michelin stars. But he didn't have an outsized interest in cooking as a child. In fact, he spent much of his youth, as many American kids do, enjoying sports, movies, spaghetti, and grandma's apple pie. But Serpico also felt as if he was caught between two cultures. He was adopted as a toddler from a South Korean orphanage in the early 1980s. And as he writes in his new book, when you're the lone Asian son of white parents whose other children are Latin and Caucasian, the reality is you stick out no matter how normal you feel. His parents were loving and supportive, but it wasn't until he married his wife and experienced his mother-in-law's incredible Korean home cooking that he began to better understand his heritage and translate this to the kitchen. Peter Serpico is with us now in studio for the remainder of the hour. His book is Learning Korean Recipes for Home Cooking, and he is also executive chef at K-Pod in West Philly. Peter Serpico, it is a pleasure to have you with us here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for having me.
So let's begin by getting into your life story some more. Your birth name is Kyung Ho.
Yes.
And again, you were born in South Korea and adopted at age two into what you call a standard issue American family. Tell us a bit about your folks and the food you ate growing up.
Yeah. So apparently when I first was adopted, my mom would make me fish and rice because that's what I was eating at the orphanage. And then gradually she weaned me onto all the foods that my family would eat so she didn't have to make two separate meals.
Yeah. Oh, well, good for her.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
The only way to go about it. So what sorts of foods? You're talking about spaghetti and meatballs and
yeah,
kind of
spaghetti bolognese. Mm-hmm. We used to eat salad with ranch dressing. She had a really famous mac and cheese recipe that I actually make for my daughter now. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty famous if you knew us growing up.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk a lot about kind of the discomfort that transracial overseas adoptees can feel kind of betwixt and between in different cultures. So let's get into some of that for just a bit. There was a protective cocoon at your home in which your family didn't see race. But the reality is, Peter, other people outside the home did. And there were, as you write, there were judgmental stares and even comments. How did this shape your perception of who you are or who you were or who you are today?
Well, I'm still kind of going through that right now. I have a daughter that's 7 years old now. She is Korean, so I think that's kind of helped me in my present try to navigate who I am and who I want to be. So I think that my upbringing and where I am now in my life are kind of going two separate paths. So I appreciate what my mom did for me and what my family did for me. They were very adamant about me trying to fit in and be American growing up. And now I'm kind of, moving away from that and, just trying to find who I am, just like everyone else in life.
Your book includes some poignant South Korea adoption history. Over a period of decades, over 160,000 South Korean children were adopted overseas. In the 1980s alone, the number totaling about, 6,600 children every year, including yourself. Mm-hmm. What was happening here that led to such an exodus of children from South Korea?
I just think that Korea is very, very, very judgmental when it comes to being like a single mother. And I think it was easier for a lot of women at that point to just put their children up for adoption instead of living through like the judgment of others. There are a lot of us out there. There are a lot of Korean adoptees out there.
And since that flow has, you know, significantly, if not completely stopped.
Exactly.
So you were never one of those chefs who knew what they wanted to do early on in childhood. But a little bit of background, you eventually spent time as a teen working in a local pizza shop and felt the kitchen was the right environment for you. And eventually in the early aughts, you ended up in New York City working in the restaurant business at the bottom of the food chain, as you put it. And the experience was brutal.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I moved to New York when I was 19. I didn't really know anyone. And I just felt like I needed something more out of my life. I really enjoyed cooking, and I wanted to be around the best. And unfortunately, I didn't feel like Laurel, Maryland had the best restaurants, and I wanted to challenge myself, and I needed something new in my life. I moved to New York when I was 19 by myself. It was very eye-opening. I'd never seen anything like that before.
Crazy hours and
everything. Crazy pace
in the kitchen.
Crazy pace. Everyone was so driven. I made absolutely no money. I lived in extreme poverty for a very, very long time. And I struggled. I struggled a lot. I wouldn't change it for the world.
Why?
And I think it was very good for me to struggle.
Why wouldn't you change it?
Just because I feel like I feel like everyone should struggle, to be honest with you. I feel like that's what produces a good human being. Empathy, just having a different perspective on life, and just understanding the value of hard work and that not everything is going to be great all the time. Hmm. And being able to get through it.
So you eventually connected with David Chang of Momofuku, and you ended up being chef de cuisine and part owner of one of the restaurants in which you got your 2 Michelin stars, 3 from the New York Times, James Beard Award, you know, all amazing stuff. But as I'm understanding this, I guess the real immersion into Korean cuisine came after your daughter Charlie was born and your mother-in-law came to stay for a while.
Exactly. So that's like super Korean. When we had our daughter, that was her first granddaughter. So of course she would move heaven and earth to be involved.
She came bearing packages of groceries,
always.
Like a trunk full or something.
Always. They always, they load up their van. They drive over. They always just bring so much food, because that's their way of showing love, to myself, my wife, and our daughter.
So what would you serve?
Oh, no. There is zero chance that I am able to serve anything when she is around. She waits on us hand and foot. She feeds Charlie, everything. I am not, I just have to sit down. The most I can do is get people water.
Well, in the introduction to your book, you write, "Korean food nourishes me in a way nothing else can. The kind of fulfillment you experience so deeply that using words to describe it seems like a disservice. What is it about Korean cuisine that makes it so enthralling?"
There's just something deep inside me that when I eat it, I feel different. I don't get that same feeling anymore from food in general. I mean, I do go out to eat at restaurants and things like that, you know, like, you know, top restaurants in the country, in the world and things. And I have such amazing, you know, bites of food, amazing meals, amazing experiences. But there's just something about Korean food, Korean home cooking specifically, that it just speaks to me. It just makes me feel whole. In a weird way, and I've never felt that from food before.
You write about the give and take of salty and sweet and the fact that it was vegetable-centric long before it was cool.
Yeah. Whenever we either visit my in-laws in Queens or they come visit us, her mom just always makes like a full spread. There's always like some kind of soup or stew. There's rice. There's banchan, which is like all the assorted vegetable dishes and things. And they all just have so much different flavors and textures. In my life now, I appreciate texture way more than I did when I was younger. And I don't even know if I'm appreciating it more or it's just becoming, I'm noticing it. And I didn't notice it before.
When you talk about texture, what are you talking about?
Like the crunch and the chew of some vegetables. When you cook them either longer or shorter, sometimes they're raw. So it's not just about like the roundness of the flavor, but it's about the texture that almost feels, in my mind, it feels healthy. In a weird way, I think that's why like a lot of people enjoy like, you know, like the al dente pasta things like that. It just makes the dish more complete.
So before you came to this, though, before your mother-in-law started cooking up a storm for you, you know, you really kind of tended toward the American, I guess, culture as far as cooking was concerned. You didn't realize that kimchi was a staple of Korean households and I guess is available for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah. So that's the toughest. A breakfast is the toughest meal period.
Full disclosure, Peter.
Yeah. So whenever we go to visit my in-laws, I usually go out with my friends and see my friends in New York. And sometimes I may or may not have too much fun and perhaps maybe have it. One or two too many cocktails. So when I wake up in the morning, as I get older, I'm not feeling 100%. And it's the morning meal period that is – the kimchi is a little bit tough to
Well, describe kimchi for people who aren't familiar with it. What is it?
So kimchi is like a staple. Kimchi and rice are the staples of Korean cuisine. Kimchi is like a fermented cabbage that is served with every meal. So sometimes it can be spicy and sometimes it cannot. My mother-in-law makes spicy kimchi a lot and it can be made with other vegetables as well. She was just over last week and brought ram kimchi. So that's like every spring, her and her husband and her sister or sister-in-law, they make ram kimchi and they make a huge batch of it and kind of disperse it throughout the family. So everyone has ram kimchi for the spring.
They're dispersing the love.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's just what they do.
So in your book, which you call, by the way, a cooking book, not a cookbook.
Yes.
What's the difference?
Well, I want people to I want them to use these recipes just as a base and not so much as this is the recipe. If you don't have this ingredient or this ingredient, you can't make the recipe. And I specifically, when I was writing these recipes, my daughter didn't like spice and she didn't like ginger that much because she was very young. She was probably 3 or 4 when we were writing the book. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the recipes have a little bit less salt than most people would like. Salt, ginger, and spice. When the spice is a lot of like gochugaru and the Korean chili flake. So we cut back on that so my daughter would enjoy the recipes more.
Well, there are also kind of shout-outs to American culture. For instance, you've got a recipe for salmon and kimchi, which looks delicious, but the original fish might have been mackerel, which is a stronger fish. So there's an option for cooks to play around a bit.
Exactly. And I want people to be able to basically buy the pantry ingredients from your Asian grocery store, your H Mart or wherever, and then be able to kind of fill in the blanks with things that are available at American grocery stores. Things like salmon, broccoli, lettuce. Just anything that's widely available instead of feeling like you have to go to the Asian market all the time to make anything out of the book.
What is your favorite recipe?
Oh, that is a tough one. I would probably say the yogurt drink because I make it for my daughter after school. That's like her favorite after school snack.
What's in it, briefly?
It's so easy. So that's the other thing with the book. I try to make sure that we have the minimal amount of ingredients. So it's just... it's Greek yogurt with a strawberry on the side. You use both. You use the strawberries and the yogurt. Lemon juice. I think it's either honey or maple syrup. And soy milk or rice milk.
Quick,
really easy.
And a great break for a kid coming home from school.
Exactly. Yeah, she used to light up when I would pick her up from preschool with that in my hand.
Speaking of Charlie, there's a charming picture of you with your daughter in the book. You're outside at the grill. She's standing right next to you looking on. So is cooking a family affair in your household? And what does she think of the work that you do?
My daughter is my biggest fan. She is my hype girl. She loves it. We actually had a conversation the other day. She told me she really likes attention because I don't like attention that much. And my wife doesn't like attention, but she wants to wear like the sparkly dress so that when she walks down the street, people comment.
Yeah.
She just bought some, her cousin bought her some gold shoes the other day.
Okay.
So she's been wanting to wear those every day. Anything shiny, she loves.
Sounds fabulous.
Absolutely. Well, she's 7, so yeah. I feel like that's pretty
normal.
Pretty normal, yeah.
For a lot of kids, yeah.
Yeah.
So among other things, you won a James Beard Award, 2 Michelin stars. So what do you think about these accolades? What sort of doors can such honors open in your field?
Well, I'm very fortunate and I'm very lucky to receive these things, but I don't think about them at all. I try to just think about the future and I try to, live in the present. So whatever I achieved in the past, I don't even think about it ever, not one second of any day.
Really?
No, yeah, I just want to. There's still things in my life that I want to achieve, and
such as what? What's in the future for you, Peter?
I don't accolades and things like that. Those are not on the table at all. The biggest thing for me is that I just want to be present for my daughter, and I want to be a better husband and a better father. And those are the things that are important to me in my life. I'm also a little bit older. I think that when I was younger that those things were more important, but now I want to be around.
So you're talking about balance. How about opening a new restaurant? Any plans for that down the road? Because right now you're executive chef at K-Pod.
Yes, we opened up 6 months ago, and that was amazing. So I helped open K-Pod, which is in West Philly. It was a previous restaurant called Pod that Steven Starr has had for 20-plus years. And he trusted us enough to try to revamp it and reopen it with a newer concept. And it's been great.
Well, listen, we're out of time, unfortunately, but Peter, it was so much fun to have you with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Peter Serpico. The book is Learning Korean Recipes for Home Cooking. And again, Peter Serpico is executive chef at K-Pod in West Philadelphia. Charlie Kyer is our engineer today. Our producer is Paige Mary Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening and be well.